Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. And today I have a very special guest. We are doing something a little bit different today in the sense that we're going to be talking about early modern plays in intersection with modern plays and modern playwriting and what we do. So my wonderful guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
My name is Mark Ravenhill. My purpose in life is really to have as much fun as I possibly can, I think. And one of the ways of enjoying myself hugely is I write plays. So I first had a play produced in 1996, and that's become my occupation, profession, and still doing it now.
So you're here in part because you made the fatal error of putting on social media that you've been reading some early modern plays of late. And was that coming about for a reason, or were you just suddenly had the yen to read something a bit older?
I mean, I think my reading of early modern plays sort of comes and goes in waves. So that wasn't the first time by any means that I've come in contact with early modern plays. But yeah, I think, I was thinking about a new play that I'm writing. And I think to read early modern plays at the time in which you're thinking about your own play is a very sort of liberating experience, because I think the range of styles, genres, devices, perspectives on the action, the range from formal poetry to more sort of jazzy poetry to prose to the colloquial to Latin, the range of language is so broad. It's just a huge, great, big, rich grab bag of theatrical possibilities. So I think over the years, our range of colours in our dramatic palette has often got much narrower than that. So I think to open that up again and reimagine all the different possibilities that open to making something for the stage, I think the most fertile, most rich, most chaotic in many ways period of writing for the theatre is that early modern period. So it's very inspiring.
Yes, we've been discussing actually in one of our sister podcasts, we've been looking at the sort of evolution of verse and the play of language over, because we cover such a large period of time. We're going all the way back to the medieval, and there really isn't a norm. There are so many different venues, so many different companies, so many from all the way through to what we might call today amateurs, through to professional writers. You have such a broad range of directions of travel, because even then, there is a sense of, well, if you're writing for four actors in a small room, you know, the studio setup is a very different job of work to writing an epic with 16 plus actors on a main stage in a modern venue. So the analogues are still there as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just on the level of rhetoric, any play still today that's going to live and breathe within a bigger theatre, 700, 1,000 seats, if you're writing for the Littleton or the Olivier, you're going to have to use the art of rhetoric, because that is the language that carries into a bigger space. So whether you're consciously doing it or not, once you move out of those 100-seat black box theatres, or even probably do without rhetoric within 200 or 300 seats, but once you're in those bigger stages, you're going to be tapping into the power of rhetoric, because you've got to create words that travel across the stage to the other performer and out to a big audience. So you're going to be drawing on the arts of rhetoric, which obviously the vast majority of us are a lot less schooled in than an Elizabethan grammar school boy. But at some stage, I think in writing for those bigger spaces, you're going to consciously or unconsciously start to investigate and start to use the art of rhetoric, which, you know, for the first time in this country, crosses from the schoolroom onto the public stage in this period that we're talking about.
And on top of that, people tend to think of the early modern stage as not being visual, as being primarily about the words and the which is a bit of a lie. I mean, there are plenty of texts, but when you're working for a big stage, you also have to be thinking about the image, the stage picture as well.
You're thinking in terms of bodies in space, and also you're thinking about when you're also going to use the power of spectacular moments that maybe are more visual, and you know, again, that there's just such a range of that within early modern plays that sometimes, you know, looking at a scene, the actual movement is more or less inscribed in the scene. If you look for the clues in the text and follow them, there's sort of coding, or sometimes directly, not even coding, direct instructions, even though there aren't stage directions, that create sort of vivid stage movement. But obviously also the art of the dumb show, the art of the mask, the art of the stage fights, and so on and so on. There is a whole range of visual and physical devices and ways of working that are in these plays. Again, I think it's, you know, richer than has often been the case in more contemporary plays.
Yes, it's interesting that often when people are restaging early plays today, they will be effectively adding dumb shows into the action, because every so often they'll need to explicate something that a modern audience may not fully understand, or a bit of context. So you'll have a bit of physical theatre going on. And of course, it's an effect that would have been used in the past, but not necessarily in that specific text.
Although yes, I think oddly now we've sometimes got a little bit too far down that route. I think we have an anxiety that we need to do something visual and physical before the play starts, because the audience will find it difficult to understand the language. And we do find it sometimes hard to understand that language, but I'm not convinced that the audience is contemporary to the plays at first wasn't just overwhelmed by two people rushing on, and there are, you know, there's often huge amounts of backstory and info dumps at the beginning of these plays for an audience even at the time. But I think often part of the excitement of these plays is, yeah, some of them have prologues and stuff, but sometimes just people rush on stage and they're in the action. And we're now quite wary of that, so often directors will put in a minute or so of people jigging around and making shapes and doing things with lights before they sort of trust the audience to engage with the play, and that's become a little bit of a mannerism. So sometimes I'd argue a little bit in contemporary productions, which I see less and less, is just start the play, get them on and get them into action, and as soon as the light's up, use the first line that the playwright wrote. So I think sometimes we overuse the sort of contemporary dumb show, particularly at the beginning of an evening.
Yes. One of the things we've been testing out is, before the show starts, have a pre-show where the actors will be coming on and doing a selective bit of text, nothing to do with the actual production they're about to see, to just tune the ear in. I think there is a definite 5-minute gap.
Oh, yeah,
that
always
sometimes happens, of getting the audience to just get used to a few archaicisms. There aren't actually usually that many, but they do crop up a lot.
I think we all have that experience with plays of this period. You know, they start, even a play maybe that you know quite well, they start and you think, I can't understand a bloody word. And then weirdly, as you say, about 5 minutes in, your ear gets tuned. It's almost like tuning into the radio. And suddenly you can understand everything, even when they're using words that you don't know what they are. You know, once you engage with the character, the action, the emotion of it all, it's weird. Then you're tuned in and language carries you, you know. And as I say, I think the idea that the audience at the time absolutely understood absolutely everything is probably erroneous, because it's such a ragbag in there of popular vulgar tongue stuff that maybe some of the audience wouldn't have got, sections in Latin which maybe some of the audience wouldn't have got, references to classical allusions that some people, you know, I'm not convinced this idea, which was really the sort of mythology in England coming out of the Second World War, that in the Elizabethan Jacobean theatre, all the classes met together in harmony and shared a story together, and there was a sort of oneness about the whole experience, was very much like in the introduction to Penguin Shakespeare's at the time. It sort of starts with, this is what Merry Tudor England was like, and the sort of ideal for people coming out of the Second World War is, what if we could have a theatre that was this harmonious and brought everybody together, a sort of shared sort of high Tory sort of idea of what the theatre was. And I'm not convinced that actually that all these different references and different levels of language and stuff didn't actually in many ways heighten differences in the the original audience as to who understood what and who was following what.
Because we have different companies, we have different audiences for different companies, we have different performance contexts. So boys' company plays will use Latin in what we might think of as an elitist fashion, because often with a playhouse play, you will have, with an adult company, you will have a bit of Latin, but then they might gloss it in English afterwards. In a play by John Lilly, that probably doesn't happen anywhere near as much, because they assume the audience is educated, or at least a reasonable percentage is. I mean, they then also have fart jokes and other things to keep.
I was going to say that's part of the pleasure of the boys' company stuff, is you can have those patches in Latin, but then you go to a piece of complete filth. I mean, often filthier than the adult companies.
Oh, absolutely! It's one of the problems we're trying to do boys' company plays with boys young people today, is that they're a little too rude sometimes.
Oh yeah, really rude.
You've obviously encountered early modern plays throughout your life. Any ones that sort of leap out as having grabbed you or connected with you on?
Well, yeah, I think I have sort of, obviously not throughout my life. As I got to A level, early modern plays had crept into both the A level English syllabus and the A level theatre studies syllabus, which was a brand new syllabus when I was studying it in the 80s. So obviously school Shakespeare, and even through A-level and stuff, quite a lot of Shakespeare, but we were studying the Duchess of Malfi and the Revenge's Tragedy in the late 80s. And I think particularly that time, it often took a few decades for syllabuses to catch up. So I think that stuff that people have been putting in place earlier in the century, T.S. Eliot and stuff, refinding, particularly Jacobean tragedy, had sort of crept its way onto the stages and then was finally on the syllabuses. So that would have been the first time those two plays that I would have encountered. And obviously, you know, particularly the Duchess of Malfi is just a really, really good play. I mean, that knocks a good 10 Shakespeare plays out of the park, just in terms of its brilliance as a play. I mean, you know, 10 of the lesser Shakespeare plays. And every time I've seen that subsequently, that's just a really, really fantastic play. Revenge's Tragedy, interestingly, sort of comes and goes in terms of fashion, and I haven't really seen that around so much anymore. So I would have done that. And then I went to Bristol University, and the Bristol University was the first university drama department to set up after the war. I wasn't there when it was founded, but and it was very much going to be, its basis was in theatre history and a laboratory space where academics who were interested in different periods in history could stage old plays. Was one of its founding principles, which was a bit, you know, becoming a bit broader when I arrived, but it was still one of the main things in the department. So, and the founder of the department, Glyn Wickham, was a medievalist. So there was still quite a strong strand of medievalism and putting on those plays. So for my sins, I was in a production of The Castle of Perseverance. I can't remember who I played. Are they all? I can't really remember. I remember
Were you good or bad, basically?
Well, I was in a boiler suit waving around a spanner, and I think I was some sort of sin. Is there a...
All the seven deadly sins. So it's basically, it's a battle between the virtues and the vices for the soul of mankind, and it is a pitched battle.
Okay, that's why I was waving around a spanner then.
Yeah,
so I was in the Castle of Perseverance as something. I don't know who would wave around a spanner. I've got a feeling I want to say Sloth, but why would Sloth be rushing around waving a spanner? Anyway, and that would have been 1987 that we did that. So I think the way that it was conceived would by the director and the designer probably was quite heavily influenced by the fact that the Bill Bryden Company at the National had staged the Mystery Cycle. And that was re-edited, reworked text by Tony Harrison from the York Mystery Cycle, I guess?
It was a bit of a pick and mix.
Yeah, that's right. He did a sort of greatest hits of, I mean, beautifully arranged text and by Tony Harrison. And Bill Bryden brought together actors from the North and used their own accents, but also located it within sort of contemporary or slightly nostalgic, looking back probably a bit to sort of 20th century working class culture of the town band and the union and the social club and that sort of culture that was sort of fast disappearing, but somebody like Raymond Williams had written about warmly as sort of disappearing working class culture. So taking it from its sort of guild associations more into sort of trade union sort of associations, and a lot of the staging of the mysteries used objects that working class people would in those days or even pre to the 80s have used in their jobs. So there were bits of industrial plant material, trucks and just simple things like, you know, scenes, but everybody had their miner's helmet with their lamp on and stuff like that. So that was very, very influential, amazing productions that's still available to watch, I think, on because they were shot for Channel 4. So ours was very much, I think, using a lot of that language. That's, I think, why I was in a boiler suit waving a spanner.
I have to say that image immediately leapt to my mind of going, I think I can, that's because that's pretty much how they did a lot of the deep.
Yeah,
the
I devils, think I was,
the,
I,
certainly the end of a Doomsday, that was everyone was in boiler suits.
I think. I was given my Barry Rutter as Sloth or whatever it was. And actually at the time that we did those, I hadn't seen those productions, but Bill Bryden sort of built up the cycle over a number of years. Mm. And then there was a big run through of them and all day in the Cottesloe, just at the point that I graduated. Mm. So with my little knowledge of medieval theatre, although obviously you didn't need to go see it at the National, but you know, I got a little bit of working knowledge of it. I went to see that, and it was an absolutely amazing experience. You promenaded. There was enough room on the balcony for people who wanted to sit down, but the majority of the audience were promenading in the space. They took the stalls out. So I saw it in the Cottesloe, and just, it was really one of the most exciting things that I've ever seen. I mean, that really grounded, earthy verse and the audacity from which it moves from intense drama and tragedy to comedy. Just that quick flip is really extraordinary. And obviously their use of the space in some way, trying to find what a contemporary version of the pageant wagon and traveling through a town and stuff, and using all the levels of theatre, moving in amongst the audience, a lot of music from folk band. I loved it so much. Then it transferred across the river. So I went back a few months later and saw and did the whole day thing all over again. And that's got to be one of the sort of richest experiences I've ever had in the theatre. And then obviously, as I was, so I'm arriving in London then at the end of the 80s, it's not so long after the RSC had opened the Swan Theatre. And for the first time, many of the plays of the early modern stage are being, or sometimes, you know, performed for the first time since in the UK on the Swan, and lots of them coming to the Barbican. And there was, some of them even came to a theatre called The Mermaid, which is now just used as a conference centre. And I think what was exciting about that was, very much before, as reflected in my A-level studies, the concentration had been on tragedy, because I guess you know, still often regarded as a higher form or something. But actually the Swan rediscoveries of the early hits were things like Fair Maid of the West and stuff like that, also embraced comedies and cross-genre things and all sorts of stuff. So a lot of that was coming, starting in Stratford, but coming into London. So I think at that period, there was a sense of, and in fact, these were like new plays, because some of them had not been seen on the stage since 1590, 1620 or whatever. And here they were on the stage. So you know, they sat in that stage, at that point, they sort of sit somewhere between, yes, they are an old play, but in many ways, they're a new play as well, because they're new to all of us. So I think that was a sort of happy historical accident that I was arriving in London just as there was that sort of big sort of explosion, really, of opening up of that repertoire. And I remember one of the I need to articulate why, really, but I think one of the plays that really struck with me, that actually I read a bit early and then was produced a little bit later by the RSC, was The Roman Actor. Now that's Massinger, I think, isn't it?
Maybe
because sometimes these plays get reattributed, you come back and you go, oh, now it's attributed to somebody else. We're used to seeing a theatre that is about the amazing power of theatre. And sometimes that can feel a bit sort of self-congratulatory. Look, we've gone to the theatre to be reminded how theatre can be wonderful and magical and and Massinger's play is so deeply cynical, really.
Yes.
But this awful position the actors are in, that they're completely owned by the emperor, but are convinced still that drama has a sort of didactic purpose, and that if they can put the right play in front of the right person, they can change things. And they try, I think, three times, and each time it sort of fails worse. And that's just, you know, it's maybe a little bit self-obsessed to me to pick out one that's so focused on theatre. But I love its I love that sardonic, cruel sort of undermining of lots of the conventions of the play within the play thing. But also, you know, genuinely, although it sort of loses some of its punch as it goes on, I think, but certainly the opening, very good about how do you find your place as an acting company within the power structures of the state? How can you align yourself? And because the actors are also struggling with the marketplace as well, and that the audiences aren't turning up. So they're trapped between trying to please the ruler and please the power on the throne and please the marketplace. And it's very clear-eyed about that. And, you know, and obviously still those things have felt very keenly by anybody who works in the theatre. And it's got, I mean, that's part of the sort of turnaround of it, the joke of it. It's got, you know, the fantastic speech in defence of the theatre in the trial scene, which is two or three scenes into the play. The leading actor of the company is taken to the court, the Senate, I can't remember, and has a wonderful speech that defends all this didactic purpose of the theatre. And not so much in modern times, but often over the years was remembered a lot more than the play and lifted out and given as actors' benefit evenings in the 17th and 18th century, the speech from the Roman actor in defence of the theatre. And of course, once you put it back in the context of the whole play, the rest of the place gleefully sort of undermines everything pretty much that he said in that defense of the theater. So I found that play just fascinating, and yeah, and that was a little bit later, but yeah, that would probably even beginning of the noughties, that there was a production of the Swan that Sean Holmes directed and then came into the West End with Anthony Scher as Nero. Which emperor is it?
It's a later emperor. It's definitely a later emperor.
Yeah, Domitian. Domitian.
I think it probably is. Let me check.
Because he's got a wife called Domitia, I think.
Yes. Yes, Domitian.
There we go. That was an early modern nerd fest contest. Name the emperor in Massinger's The Roman Actor.
Yes, and they came to London with it with The Malcontent and
City Madam maybe or something.
Yeah, something else. There were three.
Yeah,
and they did that in rotation.
Yeah,
about 20 years ago.
And you know, so I suppose we're at a moment now. Like, so that was an exciting project. Many of these plays being discovered for the first time, and then we've sort of stalled a bit because what happens when you go back to them a second time?
Yeah.
And then they've stopped being like, it's an old play, but it's a new play. So, you know, we're at a point where what do we do with that? So, you know, an interesting thing that's just happened is The Fair Maid of the West, which was a big hit for the RSC in that initial rush of plays, and that Trevor Nunn directed with, and I think that came to The Mermaid, probably, I can't remember. But with Imogen Stubbs, and coming back to it now, still on, I think, or just finished.
It's just finished, yeah.
In The Swan is, you know, Isabel MacArthur has gone back and reshaped that play and reimagined that play. In terms of the fact that, you know, it's a very, in its very playful way, but it is about the beginnings of, it's certainly very mercantilist play, and it's about the beginnings of sort of, you know, colonialism and stuff.
Oh, yes,
and,
yes.
And
it's a very difficult play to stage as
Root. Yeah. So, and, you know, and within, originally in the 80s, it was staged much closer to As Writ. So Isabel's gone back to investigate how can you reclaim the sort of rumpy quality of that play, but also the incredible female protagonist, the Fair Maid, but navigate new ways through the way that it depicts sort of journey around the world, often with quite sort of cartoony stereotypes of people from around the world. So, you know, so that's one way forward of that sort of little case study of a play that was I think probably not staged for hundreds of years before the Trevor Norman, correct?
I don't think so. A lot of plays, except for the relatively, that said, every so often you find a production that pops out of the blue. It's you'll go, you know, what was the one I came across the other day, where A Warning for Fair Women, which was, I was reading a book saying this hasn't been staged till the 20th century. And then I stumble across a melodrama in the late 19th century that is doing it. And I'm going, oh, hang on.
Yeah. So maybe that's one way forward. And but you're right. I mean, it wasn't solely confined to that period in the RSC. So there was a previous generation. And that was, the Swan became a sort of more or less consistent production line for sort of 10, 15, 20 years of early modern plays, and doesn't really do that so much now. But there were other earlier things. I mean, the director, Bill Gaskell, was particularly fascinated by Middleton. And he was an interesting figure because he was both very connected to the Royal Court, but also connected to the Royal Shakespeare Company. So he's directing new work at the Royal Court, but also at the RSC and a few other things. But Bill's particular passion, I think, was for Middleton, and he loved the acute social eye of Middleton and the bitterness. And I think he felt that the anti-romanticism of Middleton, Bill was particularly attracted to. So actually he does do things like at the Royal Court, direct A Mad World, My Masters. And this stuff did then ripple out often to regional repertory companies, which were much better funded, and more of them up until the 80s. So when I was a student in Bristol, the local theatre was the Bristol Old Vic, and I did actually see a production of The Dutch Courtesan. Actually, think about it, I think it was a production from the theatre school that was in the theatre, and I don't think that was that unusual to occasionally see theatres around the country claiming one of these early modern plays. The Dutch Courtesan had already been produced at the National in the late 60s, I guess.
I think so, yes. I can't remember. The National has a quite a good gun approach.
Yeah, and you know, Kenneth Tynan, who was the literary manager of the National, was championing those plays. I mean, he was championing the Roman actor a long, long time ago, and nobody put it on. But the Dutch Courtesan had been, I can't remember who directed that, had been at the National, so that's probably why it was popping up at that time at Bristol or Vic, that anything that the National had put on under that Olivier regime, it instantly raised its profile hugely. I remember loving the Dutch Courtesan as a 20, 21-year-old, so, and I don't think we've had a chance to see that again. And you know, that's, I'd love to see a Dutch Courtesan.
I've almost directed it about two or three times, and it always quite slips through from my fingers slightly.
Yeah, man, I've read it recently, and the Dutch Courtesan herself is a really fascinating figure. Becomes a sort of revenge thing as well. But I think she's a genuinely complex character. I found shifting my allegiances for and against her. She's the goodie, she's a baddie, she's passive, she's active, and obviously that very clear-eyed thing of the city comedy of locating her within an economy and the economics of the situation. I think that would be on my list of Colosso production plays of The Dutch Courtesan. Would be a rather wonderful thing.
One of the things about going through all of the plays and literally everything is you know, sometimes you come across a play, you think, why isn't this out there? And I came to interact with you because you tweeted about Thomas of Woodstock, which is a play that lacks an ending, which is quite frustrating.
Yeah, it was interesting because I read Richard II again, and more than a lot of the other plays, I sort of thought, this seems to be relying on the audience knowing a lot, as though something has happened before. You know, it seems to be building on something. And I never really thought that about Richard II before, but looking at it, I just thought, did somebody write something that a lot of the audience might be familiar with that sort of works as a prequel or first play or something? And so, I Googled that question, whatever I did, and I found out quite quickly there was Thomas Woodstock, which, you know, in some ways is the sort of set up for, obviously it's not intended thus to be, but I'm sure lots of the audience would have been familiar with when they brought that knowledge to coming to see Richard II. So yeah, I read something, Thomas of Woodstock sort of does that. So yeah, I got it out of the library and had a read. And, you know, and like so many plays of that period, it's very rich and full, and it's got, you know, just all the dynamics of the and the breadth of the portrait of society that it's painting. Mm. Is in some ways broader than the picture that Richard II paints of a whole world, a whole society. I mean, it's, I'm not saying it's a better play than Richard II, but I think it's got a broader canvas in many ways. And then it doesn't quite have an ending, does it? I mean, it's almost got an ending, but I think it's a few pages short.
It's a couple of pages short of an ending. The primary battle has happened. We know which way the wind is blowing. The one set of major villains are dead. Another set of major villains are getting their comeuppance. So Tressilian, the corrupt chief justice, has basically been dobbed in it. So it's just about the question of how do you reconcile Richard with the lords?
With the lords, yeah, yeah.
And that's basically the question of how to do that.
Yeah,
at the end.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you could do it with just sort of good pastiche and sort of invisible mending, or you could make something of that and declare the fact there isn't ending and sort of make a more declared sort of interventionist stating it's a rewrite. But you know, I think it would be beyond academic interest. I think it would be genuinely a great afternoon and evening in the theatre to see those two plays, John of Woodstock leading through to Richard II and I think it would, yeah, I think it would throw new light on Richard II and create a fantastic line through of a sort of history duo, history diptych or whatever you call it.
I think that's
got genuine potential to be actually speak to a theatre audience rather than just academic interest.
Yes, I mean it's got some lovely set pieces. It's got the worst wedding speech, best man's wedding speech. I think I've stumbled across recently. It's got a horse. It's always got and the horse scene is lovely.
Oh, that horse scene's great. It's one of the best horse scenes. I remember that now. Do we know who wrote it?
No, we have absolutely no idea. And it's really weird because it's such a solid play.
Yeah, it's very. It's clearly not a sort of somebody having a go. It's a very accomplished piece of theatre craft. Yeah,
and really, there's I can't figure out any fingerprints for it at all. It usually you can sort of feel like Scrooge McDuck through his money piles. You can sort of feel where it might be going, but actually, no, genuinely can't. It's got a later date. Learned people have placed it at a much later date than originally thought.
Okay, so is it now possible even that it wasn't written before Richard II?
That's the current thinking. And they're fairly certain because of the where the manuscript comes from and how it came into being. The redating seems quite firm. I haven't double checked on that.
Interesting. So my thesis is blown out of the water that the audience sort of know that play before they came to Richard II.
Well, no, it's not because we know there are more Richard II plays. The thing is, there's a multiplicity of plays dealing on the same subject on the stage at the time. We just don't have them. I mean, there's another Richard II play, which is The Life and Death of Jack Straw, which does with the Peasants' Revolt, which is the other end of the scale. It's an incredibly short play. It reads like the film script adaptation of a play. It's got all the plot beats, and it's got some good stuff, but it's only an hour long. And it does what a history play does, but it just does it in that rather.
So do you think that might have been a longer play that was then squeezed down for a sort of remix to be performed in a specific space or to tour or something?
We don't know. I mean, there's so many options. It's a really good play to discuss about the kinds of theatre that were existing in the 1590s because it might have been more designed for, say, in spaces rather than the bigger playhouses, though size of inns varied. It might have been that it was just designed to be that size and it was part of a double or a triple or a quadruple bill of plays.
Yeah.
It could have been cut down. It could be a first draft that hasn't actually fully been fleshed out.
Yeah.
It functions. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's a really nice, scalable one actor, which is what I really like about it.
Yeah. I'm sold. I'll read it. Yeah.
But it is odd. It's got a very good goose. It's got another a very good animal scene. It's got a scene with a goose, which is clearly a puppet goose. Spoilers: the goose doesn't survive.
Oh,
I'll push ahead
and read it, but I'll prepare myself for Goose Death.
Yes, it's live on stage. He's having a, the clown is having a conversation with the goose about cooking the goose, and then someone comes up behind, chops the body of the goose out from under it, and runs off with the body of the goose, and he's just left with a head, and with he's just head. Going and. You know, and it's like,
oh, it's Rod Hull all over again, isn't
it's
it?
Rod Hull all the way through, and it's we're very much looking forward to creating that goose prop because there's gonna be a lot of fun to have with it in a sort of sad goose death way.
Unless you make it a very annoying goose, if you play it more along an oval goose,
yeah,
way, then you're actually quite glad when it's dead.
Yeah I think it's probably trying to tell the clown that it's being having its head sawn off, you know, and then down it goes.
I'm just sort of thinking about what we're talking about. So I mean, one of the ways is listen, I mean, we've always edited and even tidied up and often in rehearsal slightly rewritten these plays. So it's not as though we have ever really seen the hardcore real thing. We don't quite know quite what the real thing is. So literary managers and actors and directors will often cut the plays if there's a word that's so obscure that it's going to block the audience. You know, you'll discreetly change the word. So that over the years there's always been a lot of sort of undeclared invisible mending work sort of going on in all these plays before an audience meets them. So there's a sort of spectrum towards involving a writer and rewriting them. It's not a sort of either or situation. And as part of that National Theatre project in the late 60s, the wider project of Olivier's National, Edward Bond was coming in and creating a version of The White Devil, which essentially, you know, a sort of extension of what before a literary manager, director and actor would have done in sort of making the text work on the stage, and in that case you're declaring who the person is who's doing that, because Edward Bond was at that stage probably even, you know, a little bit of a draw as a name. And then you get things later which are sort of much more declared things, and I think there's mileage to be explored in this which hasn't followed through. So because of Bill Gaskell's fascination with Middleton, you get in the 80s the Howard Barker Women Beware Women, which was happening. I read that when I was at university. It was sort of happening when I was at university, but I just read it. But you know, that's a great idea. First half, take the play up as is, or you know, as is once it's been edited a bit and blah blah blah, and then the second half go over to you, Howard Barker, and Howard Barker writes a new second half for that play. So, you know, sort of declaring that very openly and sort of creating a dialectic between the original play and a contemporary playwright who in some ways was creating his own sort of language, both language that you speak and wider sense of language of contemporary tragedy. And that, you know, I think that was a big, bold thing that nobody's quite explored things along that way, where it's definitely a sort of big intervention and an argument in some ways with the play. Obviously, what we tend to do now is, as we get more politically aware and more sensitive to issues, is we would tend to rewrite the plays to take out stuff that we might find offensive, and that's probably going to be a dominant thing. But there are other ways in which a writer might intervene, and I think there's a little clue somehow in that Bill Gaskell, Thomas Middleton, Howard Barker piece. I think there are all different ways in which contemporary writers can interact, intervene, argue with that body of work.
And it is often the second half of the play that is the problem.
I felt that very strongly with Roman Actor. I thought actually the second half, it sets up more than it delivers. And I felt Roman Actor next time around would actually benefit. Yeah, so that's a different thing. Again, that's really just making it a better play than it actually is, because it doesn't quite fully explore all the arguments and stuff that it sets up. And yeah, feels like the second half was just written the night before in a bit of a rush.
There's some we call it the curse of the final session. We usually read a play over about three sessions, and it's often the ending where you just it just doesn't land. It just doesn't quite work. Or in the case of usually with comedies, it just nosedives into the misogyny, and you're just going
right.
Yeah, this isn't a comedy ending, mate. This is a tragedy, and often with comedy, that's the big problem. The advantage was tragedy. If you don't like the people, they usually get horribly murdered, and all you need to do is add an additional stabbing, and you could, if there's someone who survives you don't like. With a comedy, the misogyny is often so baked in that you have to kind of start from the ground up to actually make people laugh, because that's if they're not laughing, it's not a comedy anymore.
Yeah.
It is the fundamental problem of, you know, I can present a tragedy where people stand on the stage and be sad, and that functions perfectly well. Yeah. But if you need an audience response, and the audience won't give it to you if they're presented the material as it stands.
Something that might have been made, you know, well, arguably, I think sometimes we patronise the past, but we say, okay, the audience at the time would have just found this a jolly comedy ending. Mm. It's very uncomfortable for us, so do we accept the fact that this moves out of the era of comedy for us, and that's great, and we have this unsettling, uncomfortable ending, as you know, all sorts of decisions are made about the ending of something like Measure for Measure? Or do we go, no, this the writer declares it's comedy, they want it's comedy, therefore dramaturgical rewriting work to reclaim it for what we find funny. So I think there are different, there's all sorts of different approaches to take, aren't there? But if it's declared above the title a, or just below the title a comedy, then what are you going to do with that?
We have nattered on for
God, we've jabbered on for
time.
Ages.
We have. It's been very. This is. I was a bit worried that we were not going to quite find the route through this, but this has been very productive.
I'm going to plug my show now.
Please do.
So I am back. The bitch is back with the Royal Shakespeare Company. So we actually start previews in February the 21st, so sort of a couple of weeks from when I'm talking to you now. And then we're on 6-7 weeks in The Swan, that space that I talked about, which was sort of built in the first place to reclaim a lot of the early modern work. So apologies, mine isn't a piece of early modern work. So it's a play about the composer Benjamin Britten and his work with the composer Imogen Hulse. It's a two-hander, but it's about they're really up against it. They've got 9 months. They've been commissioned to write this big opera for the coronation of the Queen, and it's the story of Elizabeth and Essex, an opera called Gloriana. And it's the first time he brought Imogen Hulse down to Aldborough to work with him. So there's two very strong personalities with this ticking clock of we got 9 months to get this huge coronation opera on stage. So yeah, if anybody is in the Warwickshire area, you can come to The Swan before April the first week in April the 4th, 7th, something like that. And then hopefully some further life after that, but let's see.
Yes, well, it's dealing with material from the early modern period of dealing with
there is a link. First, so there is a link.
This is not a forced link at all.
No, and Imogen Hulse was a very interested in all sorts of things, lots of early music. So she was doing a lot of research for the opera, into early music, and she brings some Dowland and stuff, and they play that, and then she was researching the dance of the period, so she dances for Britain, demonstrations of Elizabethan dance and stuff. That's all in the play. So yes, if you are an early modern theatre nerd, as you probably are if you listen to this, you do get Elizabethan music, you do get Elizabethan dances sort of quoted and used and worked in the piece alongside a more contemporary story.
Yes, so links will be in the show description, and if you're listening to this as it goes out, that should be still on. If you're listening to it beyond the first quarter of 2024,
It'll be on Broadway by then. It'll be fine.
Well, thank you very much for
thank
all your
you.
Time.
Yeah, we really nattered on, didn't we? Yeah. Thanks.